you are standing and confessing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say Black Lives Matter rather than All Lives Matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing progressive speakers to campuses and communities across the United States. If you enjoy the program, consider becoming a monthly patron to help us expand our reach and impact. For as little as $2 a month, you can gain access to special bonus audio commentaries unavailable anywhere else, as well as signed books and DVDs, among other goodies. And every donation is tax deductible, as it goes to Speak Out and help support their educational and activist mission. If you're interested, head over to www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and help support progressive podcasting today. My guest today is Dr. Robin Henderson Espinoza, a public theologian, ethicist, and trans queer Latinx activist who works both in and out of the classroom to bridge the gap between radical theory and practice. As their official bio notes, knowing intimately that the borderlands are a place of learning and growth, Robin draws on their identity and heritage as a trans queer Latinx in everything they do. From doubt to divine and everywhere in between, their call as an activist theologian demands the vision to disrupt hegemony and colonialist structures of multi-layered oppressions. As an anti-oppression, anti-racist, non-binary, transgressive Latinx, Robin takes seriously their call as an activist theologian and ethicist to bridge together theories and practices that result in communities responding to pressing social concerns. Robin sees this work as a life-orienting vocation, deeply committed to translating theory to practice and embedded in reimagining our moral horizon to one which privileges a politics of radical difference. Robin has a PhD in constructive philosophical theology from the University of Denver. We'll be talking today about issues of intersectionality in progressive movement building, what it means to be a public theologian, and what it means to exercise what liberation theologians have long called a preferential option for the poor, but expanding that to all marginalized communities and what Robin calls crucified peoples. Because we're going to be talking about issues of intersectionality, and I know that to some extent that has become a buzz phrase that many folks on the left use, I wanted to make sure that the listeners who maybe are not familiar with it or have heard it used in various contexts have a sense of what at least I mean. And my guest today, Robin Henderson Espinoza, may have a slightly different take on what it means to them. But to me, intersectionality is very simply a theory that seeks to explain an analysis that seeks to elucidate the ways in which our various identities, race, gender, sexuality, physical ability or disability, religion, age, all of those things, class, intersect and interrelate with one another to create a whole person. Too often times, historically, we have tended to reduce issues of identity into separate silos. So we have had people within social justice communities, or even just scholars studying issues of various identities, who have tended to specialize in one to the exclusion of the other. Certainly nothing wrong with folks who focus most of their attention on class or gender or race or sexuality. But if you do so in a way that tends to exclude the importance of all of the other identities relative to the one that you focus most of your attention on, you do a great disservice to the lives that people actually lead. I mean, the fact is, none of us are simply one thing or another. Our racial identity matters in a racialized society. Our class identity matters in a class system. Our gender and sex identities matter in systems of patriarchal dominance, cisgender domination, straight supremacy. Whether we are able-bodied or disabled matters, whether we are Christian or anything else in a system of Christian hegemony or no faith at all matters. So I want to sort of spend a few seconds explaining why this is important, because I feel like sometimes when we talk about this subject, there is a tendency among people who maybe are not steeped in this language or don't come out of an academic background, which is where a lot of this language tends to operate, to sort of roll their eyes at the concept of intersectionality as if it were some type of academic fad. The origins of the notion of intersectionality really come out of feminist thought and actually go back a very long way, even though the term was first used by Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, a law professor at both UCLA and Columbia, one of the leaders within critical race theory and also feminist legal scholarship, someone I've had the honor of being able to call a friend for many years now. Kim Crenshaw termed this concept intersectionality in the late 1980s, but the concept that these identities interrelate and all must be understood in relation to one another goes back to the earliest moments within really Black feminist thought. The early feminist movement was often criticized, the early dominant white feminist movement was criticized for not fully understanding what it meant to be a woman unless one was white. In 1851, Sojourner Truth delivered her Ain't I a Woman speech, in which she was talking about how her experience as a Black woman and someone who had been enslaved was obviously quite a bit different to the way in which white women in the early feminist struggle conceived of their lives and their identities, and how her identity as a woman was just completely subsumed in the mainstream feminist analysis. In 1892, Anna Julia Cooper wrote an essay called The Colored Woman's Office, in which she talked about the centrality of Black women in movements for social change, precisely because they had had so many different types of experiences with oppression, not just one, not just the other, but both. And so even though that term wasn't being used in the 1800s by those early Black feminists, certainly over time, that has become the kind of language that we use. Now, why is this important? Well, first of all, it's important that we proceed when we do social justice work with an intersectional analysis, because that's the way the world actually works, right? We don't experience the world as one thing. All of our identities matter. And just as we on the left tend to insist to conservatives that it is too simplistic to simply see people as individuals, because that's what they always say. They always say, we're not members of groups, we're just individuals. But the reality is we're not just individuals. We are individuals who have various collective identities in a social setting. We don't live in isolation. We're social beings, and we have all these different identities that shape us. If we're going to tell conservatives that, and we're going to reject, as we should, their notion of rugged, isolated individualism, then we also have to make sure that within the left, we're not doing our own version of it, which is reducing ourselves to simply one or another identity, right? Second thing is, unless we look at intersectionality, we end up elevating dominant groups within marginalized groups, which actually creates a form of re-marginalization. If we think of the LGBT liberation struggle, for instance, that movement has been typified and presented as this sort of upper middle class and mostly gay male movement, very much though within sort of the mainstream of the economic class system, and also very white. And the problem with that is when the movement ignores the needs, let's say, of working class and lower income LGBTQ folks, what ends up happening is that movement focuses on things that are likely to be of more importance to people who are, let's say, higher up in the class hierarchy. So marriage equality. Now, please don't misunderstand. I believe, obviously, if the institution of marriage is going to be available to folks who are straight, it ought to be available to everyone. That goes without saying. But marriage equality as a priority within the LGBT liberation movement has often been criticized by working class and lower income folks in the community who say, look, you know, that's fine, but what about job security, right? What about the right not to be fired? What about the right to housing? Like, if I'm struggling to survive and I'm on the margins of the society and I can't take healthcare for granted and I can't take a job for granted, I can't take a house or an apartment for granted, marriage equality doesn't mean a lot. Marriage equality ends up being a higher priority for people who have their basic needs met. It doesn't mean it's not important, but it means that prioritizing that is often the result of not having had an intersectional analysis. Many years ago, there were folks within the LGBT media, for instance, who wanted to be able to reap the benefits of advertisers for, let's say, gay publications like The Advocate, Out Magazine, etc. They actually commissioned back in the 1980s, late 80s, as I recall, a study to be done by a marketing group that would uncover the demographics of the readership of sort of dominant media gay magazines. And they did this so they could then go to advertisers and present the purchasing power as consumers of the LGBT community, but really, again, the gay and lesbian community, because the B and the T weren't really being talked about at all at the time. And of course, this data ended up showing that gay and lesbian folks had a huge disposable income, and actually a disposable income quite a bit higher than straight folks did. And they were using this data as a way to both normalize the community in a class system, but also to attract advertisers to the magazine because they could say, look, we got all this money to spend. And of course, what ended up happening was the far right started using this against LGBTQ folks, started actually saying, well, these people aren't discriminated against. Look at all this money they have. And although that was a cynical manipulation on the part of the far right, Pat Robertson, Ralph Reed, Christian Coalition, all that, because obviously, you know, the survey they did for this data was only among the readers of these magazines, which obviously is not a representative cross-section of the overall LGBTQ community. The fact remains, though, it was a predictable response, wasn't it, to not having used an intersectional analysis and instead having focused only on sort of upper income and affluent folks who buy or have subscriptions to relatively pricey magazines that you can't even find in the middle of some small town in Nebraska. So by not having thought intersectionally, that actually reinscribed the marginality of a lot of people in the LGBT community. And that has created rifts within the community, which obviously are then strategically problematic. Similarly, if you think of anti-racist work, or work against, you know, racial disparity and inequity, but you don't have a gender analysis, then you end up ignoring the special pressures that are facing women of color in favor of a male-dominated analysis that ends up reinforcing patriarchy by elevating the needs of men of color at their expense. So, for example, if you look at some of the well-intended and valuable efforts, not to say they're not valuable or well-intended, programs aimed at addressing, let's say, the criminalization of black men, which is a real problem for sure in this country. You think about President Obama's My Brother's Keeper initiative, for instance, intended to help reduce the criminalization of black men and also to reduce the gaps in well-being separating black men from the rest of the society. The problem is, if those are done in a vacuum as a way to reduce racial disparities, but only for really men of color, it runs the risk of erasing awareness of all the ways that women of color are specifically targeted. You can think about the way, for instance, that women of color have been really the ones targeted by some of the most heartless welfare reforms, quote unquote, cutbacks in public assistance. Similarly, you think about disproportionate punishment in schools, K through 12. We talk about that a lot. And My Brother's Keeper and other initiatives aimed at black and brown men have focused a lot on the school to prison pipeline within those schools. But the analysis is almost always only about boys and young men. Interestingly, as the African American Policy Forum has found, and just as a matter of full disclosure, this is a group that I've served on the board of advisors for several years, black girls and young women are suspended and expelled from school at a much more disproportionate rate relative to white girls and young women than black boys and young men are relative to white boys and young men. In other words, as bad as the disparities are between black and white boys and young men, the disparities between black and white girls and young women are even greater, like six times larger disparities or something like that. And yet we don't even talk about that. So the needs of black and brown girls end up getting ignored as we focus on the one. Again, an analysis of intersectionality would help us not recreate that kind of thing. Likewise, a lot of people out there who talk about economics a lot, talk about corporate power, Bernie Sanders, people like that, right? But they don't talk about white supremacy. Then what ends up happening is we elevate the white working class specifically so that those things actually become conflated, right? We hear the term working class, and if you ask people what they envision, it's like white people, and usually, let's be honest, white men. So if the class analysis, if the class work doesn't have a sex and gender analysis, we ignore and erase the experiences of women of whatever color, non-binary folks, trans folk, who are also working class. So the image of working class politics, right, this whole notion of like reaching out to the working class in the post-2016 election, we're thinking of white dudes who work on assembly lines or white guys who work in the mines. We're not thinking about Latino women who clean the hotels, who are every bit as much part of the working class. In fact, there's a disproportionate percentage of the working class in this country are women, and specifically women of color. But yet that's not who we see because our class politics tends to elide that, tends to erase that. Likewise, if you do gender work and you're thinking about sex and gender and the marginalization, let's say, of women as women, oftentimes, if you don't have a race analysis, you end up focusing on white women. The classic example of this is in, let's say, you think about issues of violence towards women, domestic violence. Let's start with that. Sort of mainstream dominant white feminism and the white women's movement sort of analysis around domestic violence is the notion of mandatory reporting, right? That a mandatory arrest. Number one is this idea that women who are abused by their partners should absolutely in all instances report, and that police, when they come, are oftentimes required to make an arrest. Now, on the one hand, that may seem like very sound advice, putting aside how difficult it is, putting aside how easy it is when one is being beaten to sometimes internalize the blame for that and the shame for that and not to report, putting that aside for a second, at least in theory, the notion of, you know, universal reporting and mandatory arrest makes sense. But if you're a woman of color, and then especially if you're a woman of color who is working class and low income, the experience of calling the cops on your partner is a very different experience than the same experience for a middle-class white woman. Middle-class white woman calls the police on, and I'm not saying it's easy for them either, please don't misunderstand, but if a middle-class white woman decides to call the cops on her abusive husband or boyfriend, for instance, she has every reason to believe, number one, the cops are probably going to come out. Number two, the cops are going to most likely take her complaint and her concerns seriously and her fears seriously. And third, that they're not going to run her name for outstanding warrants or ask her all kinds of questions that attempt to criminalize her for some other thing they think she might have done or for something that her son might have done or her cousin might have done or her neighbor might have done. They're not going to look at her with suspicion. And so it is a safer call to make. And if a black woman, particularly low-income black woman, does the very same thing, she's got to think about a lot of things. Number one, the fact that she could be contributing to the incarceration of yet another black male, which is something she may very well not want to do because she sees what the effect of that is in her community. So even though she's being abused and battered and marginalized by a black male, she may not want to contribute to the process whereby that person's life is completely derailed by incarceration. Secondly, she may be worried that when the cops roll up, their intentions for her and others in the low-income community of color are not necessarily the best. Are they really going to view her as a victim, or are they going to start wondering what she's done? Thirdly, if you're low-income, woman of color being abused, there are communities in this country where if you're in public housing and you're being abused, or not even just public housing, if you are renting an apartment, and let's say you've got maybe a Section 8 voucher, but you're renting from a private landlord. If you call the police too often, there are literally women who are being terminated from their leases, who are being evicted for calling the police too often because it is seen as a neighborhood disturbance, a nuisance, and the landlords don't want to put up with it, and the other people in the community don't want to put up with it. And so if you're a low-income woman of color, that's who it's happening to disproportionately. Calling the police could actually result in you being homeless. If you live in an upper middle class or affluent community, that's not going to happen. So again, we have to have some intersectional analysis because otherwise we end up with a mainstream dominant white women's movement historically that, you know, fought for what? It fought for jobs, you know, the right women to have jobs outside the home on equal terms. Well, that's a great thing. Obviously that needs to happen, but that lacked a class and a race analysis because black and brown women had always been working outside the home. In fact, black and brown women had been working in white folks' homes as well as their own homes. So to talk about wanting to have jobs outside their own home was like, you know, black and brown women and poor women, and not even just that, white women who lived in rural areas had almost always been working on the farm, for instance. You know, for those women, fighting for jobs outside the home was not really a net gain. They might have preferred the fight for guaranteed health care. The right, later on, the welfare rights movement fought for a decent, sustainable public safety net, right, for women who wanted to be able to stay at home with their children in spite of being low income. So there were just other priorities for those kinds of women.
And the problem with all of this is not just academic, it's strategically unwise. If you're trying to build a coalition for social change, you have to honor all parts of the coalition, or else your coalition is going to be weaker. And I have some firsthand experience with that because back in the 90s, I did some work as a community organizer in New Orleans. And one of the things we were dealing with at the time was the punitive welfare reform bill, which ultimately would be passed in 1996 and signed into law by Bill Clinton. And a lot of times, those of us who now realize the importance of intersectionality didn't always see the importance. And so back in 96, you know, we were very good, obviously, at seeing the class aspects of the welfare reform fight. These were lawmakers attacking poor people. We could see at least some of us, those in the South, I think in particular, and those of us who were working with explicitly anti-racist groups, which I was, could see the racial aspect, the racialization of the welfare debate. And because it was women, we could see the gender component. And most of us did a relatively decent job of talking about the sexism involved. But one thing we missed, which weakened our coalition, not only for that struggle, but I think for years afterward, was that there was also an element of this that touched on straight supremacy and homophobia. And we didn't talk about it at the time. At least I know I didn't, and none of the people in the coalitions that I was part of did. And I think it was a huge oversight. What was one of the arguments that the folks pushing for welfare reform would always make to poor single moms? They would always say, well, you know, A, get a job, of course, right? As if it were that easy. But B, get a husband. Right? That was always their argument. Well, if these folks would just get married, right? The problem is they're single moms. They've never been married. They need to get a husband. They need to get married. They wouldn't need welfare if they had a husband who was a breadwinner. Now, aside from the absurdity of thinking that it's just that easy, right? Like, obviously, just getting a husband, it's not like going down to the store and buying, you know, like a can of pinto beans. The problem is, aside from the fact that it ain't that easy to just go find a man, if you are not heterosexual, you ain't looking for a man. And so there was a homophobic straight supremacist element to this, right? If you're telling women to get a man, your assumption is that they are straight. And I know some people say, well, they've got children, they're on welfare, they must be straight. No, just because you got a kid doesn't mean you're straight. And yet if your lawmakers are saying that's the solution to your dilemma, that's no solution at all. So what we should have been doing was reaching out to the LGBTQ community and saying, hey, let's talk about how this is a coalition issue. We understood the race piece, we understood the class piece, we understood the gender piece, but we overlooked the sexual piece. And as a result of that, by not talking about how sexual identity and sexual orientation play into it, we missed an opportunity to bring in a whole nother group of people who really weren't thinking about those kind of issues, but would have added to the coalition, and we would have been able to then build relationships many years out that might have served all of those communities very well in other political battles, right? And so then down the line, when people of color were getting blamed, as they were, for torpedoing marriage equality in California, voting for Proposition 8, which was to ban marriage equality. And there was a big No on 8 campaign. Afterward, because of some pretty sketchy statistical analysis, black folks in California were blamed for that by white LGBT media and activist leaders who were angered by the way that black folks apparently didn't support LGBT liberation and marriage equity. Of course, it wasn't black folks' fault. Prop 8 was bankrolled by the Mormon church. It was not bankrolled by Black Baptist. It was not bankrolled by the AME church. It was not bankrolled by black folks at all. It was done by white, disproportionately white Mormons. But black folks took the hit rhetorically. And why? And then that created an even greater rift between black activists who focus on race, let's say, and some of the white LGBTQ activists. And then, of course, and it left black and brown LGBTQ folks totally in the middle of this, torn both ways, right? Trying to bring everybody back to the table around intersectionality. If we who had done, let's say, welfare reform work had made some of those relationships and those connections around intersectionality a decade earlier, then some of that division could have been avoided. So intersectionality is not just an academic theory. Intersectionality is not just this fancy thing that we say to sound smart. Intersectionality is the only way in which anti-racist politics, class politics, feminist politics, queer liberation politics, how any of this gets done effectively. And I'll be talking about that and much more today with my guest, Dr. Robin Henderson Espinoza, when we return. Be back in just a second. Robin, thank you so much for taking the time to make this possible. I'm really excited to be able to have a chat with you as it relates to your work as a public theologian. And I want to start by examining that concept with you for a second, because I know it's a term you use to describe the work that you do. And yet I would imagine there are lots of folks who maybe when they hear that term, they're not familiar with it. They don't know what it means. When I hear of it, you know, I think of a theology that's open to all, accessible to all, speaks to the needs of a public that's often forgotten when we talk about theology, because sometimes theology is like this received wisdom from a very hierarchical sort of set of experts, right? It's the minister, it's the priest, it's the pope, it's the imam, it's the rabbi. So what does it mean to you to be doing theology publicly? And why is it so important, you think, for us to maybe reconceptualize what theology could be?
Well, I think first I should say I come from a people who have not had access to education or educational privilege, who have been on the move from Oaxaca, Mexico for decades. And my people who are indigenous to Mexico being on the move, I think about those folks when I think about doing public theology, that what I'm really trying to do is to do theology for the people. And that means that you're doing theology by the people if you're doing theology for the people. And so public theology historically has been, I think about like the Niebuhrs and the Kings and so forth, that there has been a history of a singular voice, which has been male and predominantly white, with the exception of people like Cornel West and Martin Luther King Jr., that have done what we think of as public theology. But the problem with that is it focuses on the singularity of a person's experience that is raced, that is class, and that is gendered. And so as a non-binary transgender Latinx, I am trying to start from the bottom up, be with the people, in the streets with the people, to motivate the middle that will hopefully change the top. And so it is very much a theology from below. So in that sense, it's liberationist. If I could just use that term, liberation theology.
Well, one example I know of, I was looking at some videos of you online talking about some of this. And one of the things you said that speaks, I think, really beautifully to what you just said is you made this statement at the outset of this video that crucified people are my people. And I found that really powerful because when you say that, you're very clearly identifying with a particular people, because not everyone's a crucified person, literally or metaphorically, right? Some are crucified and some are the Roman authorities. Some are the Israelites and some are Pharaoh, right? In biblical terms. So what does it mean to commit to identifying with the crucified, or to, you know, exercise what liberation theologians have long called a preferential option for the poor, or even just to use that crucifixion imagery, which, you know, for so many Christians in the West is a very singular symbol. Yeah. Like that means Jesus on the cross. Yeah. And if you're someone like James Cone uses that imagery in the cross and the lynching tree, and others have used it. And, you know, some people get, wait a minute, don't use that imagery. So what does it mean to say, no, that's where I'm going to stand, and that's with whom I'm going to stand?
If we are going to talk about crucified people, we also need to use it in the context of Black Lives Matter and the ways in which black and brown bodies are being systematically executed by the state, by the empire, right? So when I think about crucified people, so that is particular language that I get from the tradition of Christianity. But, you know, crucifixion, it doesn't always look like Jesus on a cross, right?
But it's state violence. And that's
it is state violence. Yeah. And so that is the point that I'm trying to make, that I, you know, my people are crucified people. My people are the ones who are most impacted by state-sponsored violence. And so, you know, when I think about if my mom can't understand what I'm saying, then I'm not doing the best public theology, right? So I think it's a good question of why do you use this language, which is metaphorical and figurative and hyperbolic on some level, and also it's literal. And so I want to be real clear, especially with my white siblings, that when folks celebrate Good Friday and the crucifixion of Jesus in their Easter vigil, they are so quick to get to Easter Sunday and for the resurrection. And what they skip over is Holy Saturday. And my people sit in the unknowing of whether there is going to be a resurrection. And so when I say I'm with crucified people, it means I'm sitting in Holy Saturday with folks. It means that I am grieving and lamenting the reality that all of us are subject to the same violence, and those who are most impacted are those with dark skin.
Well, one of the things, the thing about not knowing if the resurrection is coming, that was something else I heard you say in another interview, and I found that really resonated with me because I know that in the work that I do, you know, you always come to that point in the question and answer session after a talk where somebody, usually white, usually straight, cisgendered, and middle class or above, and I would say disproportionately male, though not always, will say, what do we do, right? How do we fix this? And they really want to move toward, whether we're thinking in scriptural terms or whether we're thinking in just more humanistic terms, solutions, right? Resurrection and or the fix. And I think part of that obviously comes from a privileged positionality that says, well, we got a problem, we got to fix it. Whereas marginalized people know, A, it's more complicated, B, it takes more time, and C, it may not be coming. And I think that's something dominant group members sometimes don't conceptualize. What is it like when you bring that up to, because I know you teach classes, when you're speaking to students, many of whom have a different positionality than your own, oftentimes coming from relatively privileged space, how do you help them get their head around that idea that before we jump to resurrection, before we jump to solutions and liberation, we got some stuff we got to deal with right in the present, and that it may not happen? Because I gather from my experience, it's really hard for privileged people to let go of that need for efficacy and success and effectiveness, even in movement work.
Yeah, I mean, I also want to say that solution-based, outcome-based, getting the fix is wrapped up in a particular imagination of whiteness. It is a symptom of white supremacy to keep things intact, keep things neat and tidy, society, respectable, stable. That is about whiteness. That is about a culture of whiteness. And the reality is that we have all been socialized by this culture. People of color capitulate to that reality, but we are always sort of running against the fact that we're going to sit in it and think through strategically and tactically, how do we respond to pressing social concerns? So a real live example is this recent tax thing that is happening. And what we know is that to use a class hierarchy, those with more money, when the new tax thing goes in effect, they are less likely to spend. They're going to save. The folks who are going to spend the most are poor and marginalized people. Why is that? Because they don't have access to the funds. That is a systematic issue around race and class, I think, right? And so when I think about getting a fix to things like the overwhelming misuse of taxes in this country, I think of the ways that, I mean, our policies and politics are embedded in white supremacy. And the ways in which we are not attending to those who are most impacted is a reflection that we are not invested in solutions. We are not invested in making it right or equity. What we are invested in is the myth of progress. Mm-hmm. And we need to be real clear that progressive politics, quote unquote, progressive politics is a myth. Because you're not progressing from one thing to another. It is still part of the liberal project. And in as much that the Obama presidency did good, we need to hold the deep complexity that progressivism is still wrapped up in a particular culture of whiteness that is solution-based only for a few.
Absolutely. And I think holding that tension is one of the things you speak a lot about holding on to this in-between place. Mm-hmm. Where you can have contradictory understandings of the moment that you're in. Because we live in a very, I mean, Western culture generally is incredibly binary and dualistic, right? So we just, it's either this or it is this. And so to even say something like, we can appreciate these positive developments that take place under the Obama presidency, and that's hard for some people. Because the minute you get to the and, it's like, well, wait. Or the minute you even say, well, there were some positive things, there are others who will be like, well, no, there's nothing. As opposed to saying, wait, let's sit with that tension, right? What do you find most challenging in the work that you do for yourself sitting in that tension? When does it get hard? And then when you're speaking with others, maybe in the class who you're teaching or those who you're trying to bring along to that point, what do you find is hard for them in sitting in that place of uncertainty and the middle ground between A and B?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the notion of non-dual thinking mm-hmm. or non-binary thinking is really foreign to a lot of us.
Yeah.
I had a recent experience. So I've been writing my book in the Bay Area, and I walked out into the backyard, and there were a bunch of kids who were being taken care of. And a little kid came up and said, "Are you a boy or a girl?" And, you know, this kid is probably 3 or 4 years old. So even at 3 or 4 years old, we have the language of binary. And imagine spending time with an early 20-year-old or mid-20 person who has been shaped by the logic of the binary. And when you introduce non-dual thinking or even non-binary trans stuff, it breaks the brain on some level.
Yeah.
Because we're so socialized into a logic of the norm that is fortified by the binary. And so the hardest thing that I have is, it's hard to trust the process because there's so much fear and anxiety that people have in engaging the process. So that's just a thing, right? Like trusting the process, trust that we all sort of are on the way and can lean into it. The other thing that I struggle with is when I say I'm a non-binary trans person, believe me. Like, it's not about being male or female.
Right.
Like, that's not an option for me. I don't identify with either. And I identify with both. And so
no need to parse it, second guess it,
right.
Try to interpret it. Just accept what you're saying is real.
Right.
Right.
And I think a big thing, you know, because we've all been socialized by the logic of the norm and the language of binary and dualism, right? And the mind-body split, right? All of that, right, that we've inherited, that it's really hard for folks to say, okay, yes. They just don't have the imagination. And so my hope is in my work that as much as I talk about all the things that I do in public, that also it's a deep invitation for aligning the interior life with lived practice.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, what strikes me about it is even taking it out of the issue of the gender dynamic, just the notion of binary is maybe the one of the most deeply rooted features of Western cultural thought. I mean, going back to the Greeks, who we like to think of as the progenitors of Western thought, that's a whole other conversation.
Right, but right.
Like the idea that there's good and there's evil, and there's male and there's female, and there's reason and emotion. And of course, in theology, there's also this history, certainly within the Judeo-Christian tradition, and especially the evangelical Christian tradition, of the saved and the damned, right. The believer and the non-believer. What you're saying about breaking the brain a little bit is also maybe about, at least in my experience, there are people who, once they're introduced to a concept that so fundamentally challenges the seedbed of their cultural assumption, they're also really afraid of couple things. Number one is like making mistakes. Like I run into that a lot. People who are horribly afraid that when you introduce, even when you talk about white supremacy, when you talk about heteronormativity, when you talk about transphobia, when you talk about patriarchy and misogyny, there's that idea of like, oh, I'm having to relearn these things, and I'm having to think about systems, and I'm having to think about stuff that no one at 3, let's say, or even 13 or 20 maybe taught me. And I'm afraid I'm going to do the wrong thing, say the wrong thing. We're so afraid of like making a mistake and then having to just sit with the tension of having made it and then go, all right, I'm going to do better. Like, why is that so hard for people in this culture to get so bent out of shape about screwing up or not knowing, just not knowing stuff too?
Well, I also want to say that that's also racialized, right?
Yeah.
And so as much as we talk about the gender binary, we also have to talk about the ways in which the gender binary is racialized, yeah. Right? Why are trans women of color being disproportionately killed? Why is that? That is about race and that is about toxic masculinity. So I spent a lot of time sort of talking about the internalized misogyny that is in the queer community, that is in the trans community. I often tell the story about many years ago when I began using the language of, oh, I am trans. This is my reality. I don't identify as male or female. I neither identify and I both identify, right? Yeah. That the conversation was, well, you need to go on testosterone. Which is what often happens when people begin to transition. And because, quote unquote, my transition has been really since I was in college of sort of coming to understand my gender and also, you know, being born of a Mexican woman out of this country who has light skin privilege, who passes as white unless I'm speaking Spanish, that my transition has been influenced by my racial analysis, by a power analysis around gender, by my masculine of center presentation. And so what was said to me, and I was living in Denver at the time, and I had just started my PhD program, and the folks in the trans community said, well, you need to go on T. And I said to them, if that is the only way I can be legitimated as a trans person, I don't want it. Because that is not my story. And the idea that it is either going on T or it is not.
Right.
If that is what makes you trans, we are failing one another. Yeah. Because for some of us, we don't need to engage the medical system or the medicalization of being trans. That for some of us, it is not about a linear transition. And this is also a solution-based framework, if you will, right? That, and for some people, it's real, right? They need to go on T. It helps them be their best self. But we need to be able to hold the tension and the complexity that linearity is wrapped up in a particular racialized imagination. And that is failing people of color, that is failing queer and trans people. And on some level, that is killing trans women of color, because what it produces is a notion of linearity that you're either X or Y, male or female. We breed into all of this a particular misogyny and patriarchy and toxic masculinity. We fetishize masculinity. We think masculinity is sexy. We demonize femininity. This binary is also wrapped up in a racial awareness and a power analysis that needs to be happening. So I sort of think that we can't separate race, class, gender, sexuality from any of this when we're thinking about engaging the bottom to motivate the middle to change the top.
Well, I know that the data that I saw as of yesterday suggests that this year is on pace, as far as official records are concerned, to be the deadliest year on record for trans folk. 25 that we know of, obviously, murders of trans people. I'm sure the number is quite a bit larger than that. That's what we know of, identified as such. 80% of those trans women, disproportionately folks of color, like you said. And it does strike me that, and you've written about this, and I want you to talk a little bit more about it, because this is something I've been thinking about for a while, trying to get my head around, and your comments and some of your writing helped me think it through. It strikes me that violence disproportionately against trans women and trans women of color, as you said, because these things are connected between race and gender and sex and all these things. The fact that it is so disproportionately against trans women, identified trans women, raises this obvious issue of misogyny in a way that as a contributor to transphobia, so that these are not separate identifiable things. They're very much connected things. And I was thinking about this a year ago when all this absurd debate about bathroom bills was taking place, and all of the folks, it seemed, who were the most transphobic in their comments about, oh my God, the sky's going to fall if we let people actually go to the bathroom of the gender that they are and that they identify. All the examples that I ever heard were about trans women, right, that were going to be predators, which aside from the absurdity of that, it was interesting. The imagery was always trans women that folks were afraid of. And all I could get my head around in that was there was this embedded misogyny because the trans women are seen as having rejected the masculine.
Right.
Right. So when you reject the masculine, that's when there's really something wrong with you.
Right.
Right. That's not to say trans men don't face ridiculous transphobia as well and non-binary folks, but there is this special contempt for people perceived as male at birth or and assign male gender at birth who somehow reject that. It's like, in addition to being trans, how dare you reject the masculine? And you told a story in one of your writings about a conference, I guess, that you were at where there was a cis woman who was having a conversation with someone, found out that that person was trans female and had a very different reaction. Tell that story because I thought it was really powerful.
Yeah. So I was at a conference. I was actually having lunch here in Nashville with a dear comrade, Lindsay Godwin, and we were sort of exchanging stories about the recent conference we were at. And, you know, over a hot cup of coffee, she began to tell the story that was that a cis queer woman was sitting talking with another woman, and a trans man of color walked up and began engaging in conversation. And as soon as this cis queer woman, white woman, learned that the woman to whom she was speaking was a trans woman, mm-hmm. she became very cold toward the trans woman. And then almost in sync began to fetishize and sexualize the trans man of color. That is a problem both of internalized misogyny and the ways in which we herald patriarchy as a particular norm that guides our social practices. Mm-hmm. That is also about fetishizing people of color, which is a problem, and it's a reflection of white supremacy in many respects. And so I spent a lot of time addressing the fact that we are socializing trans men into sort of an emboldened reality of internalized misogyny that I think they're not aware of. And we are socializing them into toxic masculinity, that these trans men are so proud to be men. And it is not that you shouldn't be proud. You should absolutely be proud that you're living who you want to live, that you're connected with who you are. But at the expense of female-identified, women-identified people, then we are perpetuating a toxicity, a gendered toxicity that ultimately is killing people.
Right, right. And if you're, well, I remember having this conversation with, after listening to Teek Milan talk about this a couple years ago and then having a conversation with him about that. He was talking about that. He was talking about as a black trans man coming to appreciate fully in a way he had not previously what it meant to be male in patriarchy and in a system of misogyny and rape culture and all of that, and especially what it meant to be a black male, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that identity taking on this, like you said, fetishized place, this place of a perceived danger and mm-hmm. a perceived masculinity that's almost a hyper-masculinity.
That's right.
And so masculinity is toxic generally within a culture of patriarchy, but then you add to that the notion of white supremacy and what that layers upon black men and brown men. And it is a real, it can be a real mindfuck if you're not, you know, if you're not thinking contextually about the intersections of those identities. And so I can imagine that someone who's coming to identify and clearly say who they are and be who they are in the world, never maybe having thought about it from that place before,
right,
until you're in it, it's got to be like, oh shit, now there's this other thing I got to deal
with.
I mean,
I remember having a conversation with two trans guys and I said, part of your transition was about internalized misogyny. Like, if you think about it psychoanalytically. And they just, like, they didn't have the imagination, right? They just wanted to be a boy. They just wanted to be a man. And we need to remember that even in my own transness, I need to remember how I am disidentifying and identifying and the relationship of that and also the impact of that. Because I move in the world in a particular embodiment, when I am walking with a femme-identified person, I get lots of privileges that she doesn't get. I need to be aware of that and also stop it. And we need to be able to help folks have a larger imagination around gender. I mean, I'm recalling when I was in Charlottesville on the ground at the protest that, you know, I was in my clergy collar and a pair of shorts and wearing a stole, and I am like the embodiment of what they hate in many respects, right?
Yeah.
And being confronted with a masculinity that I think is one of our greatest social sins, to be confronted with that and then also to be threatened by that in such a way that I had to be evacuated tells me that we are still missing the mark. And we need to do better in doing a deep, deep intersectional analysis that talks about gender from the place of race and class and sex. And I think as we see these white supremacist rallies pop up, we need to be thinking about how do we dismantle the masculinity, right? It's not just about race anymore. I mean, it's always about race.
Right. And it's always about sex and gender and all these things. Right, that's right. Right, right. Well, that's the thing I think that does get missed a lot in this moment, right, is this moment of Trumpism and this white nationalist resurgence is sometimes seen only as about one of these things. You know, we talk about it being obviously about white racial anxiety and resentment and backlash and what Carol Anderson calls white rage, but there's no way to separate Trumpism and these guys, mostly guys in Charlottesville and on the web, on 4chan and all these other places, from the notion of toxic masculinity, because that comes up in all of their work.
Right.
When you talk to students in classes about this, or when you're out lecturing and speaking to folks, do you sense that people are starting to wrap their head around these intersectionality pieces in ways that 10 and 15 years ago, they really were not? Not only did they not have the language, but just even when it was brought to them, it was like, you know, they're mind blown kind of thing. Are people in your classes, are students, are people you're working with able to hold on to these connections better? And what are some examples that you've seen of people having that awareness or maybe not? Because I think those are both important.
Yeah, I mean, I think students are having aha moments. Yeah. So I think that our society has caught up with the discourse, with the theory on some level. They're saying, oh, that makes sense. I now understand that my white male privilege has this impact with women. Well, what I think we need to work on is the second step. It's not just having the aha moment, right, the consciousness raising, but helping students live out a particular narrative of who they are that doesn't continue to perpetuate multi-system oppressions, right? We need to figure out pedagogically, right, in our imagination of teaching, how to do that, both in the classroom as professors and also sort of on the road as we're speaking to folks. So what I think is we need to be speaking to both administration and students, because if we're not addressing the systemic issues of power and toxic masculinity and patriarchy on an administration level and the ways in which the academy is structured, we're then not able to address the climate of the classroom.
Right.
So that's true of the church. That's true of politics, right? So there needs to be sort of a strategic intervention in the public work that we're doing, which is in part what I'm trying to do as a public theologian, to translate theory to action and to help folks see that, like, what is happening on the ground in the streets of protest is a particular faith and values living out loud, right? Mm-hmm. It's a particular moment of theology and ethics that is unencumbered by academia. What we know about movement work is that it requires both structural change and relational change, which is why I think we need to be addressing both sort of administration and the climate of the classroom.
Right. Well, one of the things, too, that I think it brings up for me is that you're not just fighting against the alt-right white nationalists, hyper-misogynists that show up in places like Charlottesville. Maybe the bigger adversary for a lot of the social justice work and liberation work that needs to get done is something that I've heard you refer to before in some of your work as resistance to indifference, right? This sort of, it's not the overt hostility that's always the issue. It's also this notion of just sort of a shrug, like a collective shrug that takes place. And one of the things that I'd read that you wrote, you said, challenging these ruling theologies, what I call supremacist theologies, requires the creation of a counter theology, one of resistance to indifference, and that has to be rooted in the act of bridging. So I want to ask you two things about that. Number one, how do we get people who are not overtly hostile to the notion of really transformative social change, but they just feel maybe so powerless that indifference sometimes stems from, it's almost a defense mechanism against a feeling of powerlessness. In other words, you're not really indifferent, but you affect a mentality of indifference or nonchalance because you just feel so cut off from the means of actually producing change that you withdraw. Right. And then secondly, what does it mean to bridge? Because one of the other things that I've heard you refer to is the importance of finding unity in difference. And again, that is like a binary breaking phrase, because the notion of unity and difference are presented as adversarial opposites or oppositional, when really what you're trying to do is create a new synthesis from these things.
Right.
So I know that's a big question with lots of stuff, but wherever you want to go with it, I'd love to hear.
Yeah, I mean, so the resistance to indifference piece is that we get so wrapped up in the minutiae of the everyday that we become overwhelmed with all that needs to be done.
Yeah.
Let's take recycling as an example.
Okay.
So many people don't recycle because they don't have the bandwidth. Like, if there is not a container right there for them, they're not going to do it. As a result, they become indifferent to environmental change, right? Doesn't mean they don't want to do it. It just means that the shitstorm that we're in results in us being indifferent. And on some level, it's about convenience,
right?
So indifference is about convenience.
Right.
And also, it's that we are tired and fatigued and overwhelmed with all that is happening in the world. And yet, we cannot stop there. We have to find a way to harness our imagination so that we can lean into the struggle of resistance so that we do not become indifferent. The question about how do we privilege difference in the world is some of the work I'm doing around the politics of radical difference. In order for difference to exist, it means that it is non-normative. Norms and values are connected for us in this world. When there is a norm, it produces a particular value. To suggest that we need to be unified in our difference is to suggest that we find ways to accompany one another in this life that produces a type of togetherness or a unity in light of our radical difference. So one of the ways that I do that is I bridge with white people. As a public person and also as a theologian, I have lots of folks who sort of call me for pastoral advice and to have pastoral presence with them. And I have learned that what people need is just a chance to be heard. The same is true for people of color and for white people. And I am not trying to minimize the fact that people of color are being ignored or the fact that white people take up too much space. That is all true. And part of that dynamic is because we don't know how to listen. Mm-hmm. And we don't know how to be heard. And so my work around bridging with white folks is just trying to model a different way to be human with folks. What I'm interested in when I talk about bridging with white folks is the real human work that I think I'm called to do of addressing the limitations of who we are and addressing the deep coalition that we can have together.
Yeah, well, and this goes back to the piece about sitting in the tension and the in-between space, because part of what we do in movement work too sometimes is because we have, let's say, within liberatory movements, you know, we like to think that we have a very deep systemic understanding of where the bullshit comes from and what the sources of the problem are and all of that. And sometimes when you get really deep in that, though, it's very hard to sit with the tension of saying, on the one hand, here's how these systems elevate some and destroy others, privilege some and marginalize others, and sitting with the also point, which is that even those who are dominating, oppressing, and marginalizing others and privileged by those systems are dehumanized by those systems. Getting people to accept the idea that it's okay to discuss, not at the expense of the target of oppression, but in concert with that discussion, it's okay to discuss the way that misogyny dehumanizes men. It's okay to discuss the way white supremacy dehumanizes people called white. It's okay to discuss the way that cis supremacy, transphobia, straight supremacy dehumanize straight and cisgendered folk. And finding that balance, though, about how we do that without recentering those dominant groups can be tough. Do you think there are better or worse ways for us to hold that tension? Or is it about practice? Is it about getting used to having that conversation and learning when you're recentering perhaps in a way you shouldn't, or when you're crowding out space? Because we obviously have to do both of those things. If we're going to really lean into this notion of bridging, we're going to have to hold that tension about both being privileged and hurt.
Yeah, so, you know, let me just sort of call on my training. As someone who's trained as both a theologian and ethicist, I have a high anthropology, right? I believe that we are good. And also, we suck sometimes, right? And so, what is the task at hand? It is in the everyday. Every day we have to commit to living out a politics that is liberative, that is transformative every day. And that means calling people in and calling out. Mm-hmm. And it means committing to structural change just as much as you're committing to relational change. I mean, I get lots of flack. Why are you in conversation with all these white people? Well, because they need liberation too, right? So I talk a lot about like my liberation as a person born of a Mexican woman on this country is also wrapped up in the fact that I have a white father. Right. And so the very blood that I have is intermingling and is bridging together to make me thrive. Why then am I not also committed to living that out in practice, right, out loud? That is the work of revolution. It's revolutionary to think about folks coming together in deep conversation that are collaborating their liberation. That is the work that we need to do. So we need to take it in stride, and we also have to commit to naming cis supremacy, we need to name white supremacy, we need to name all of that stuff, and we need to remember that we are failing to be human with one another, and in order for us to be human with one another, we have to have sort of grace and compassion and practice the everyday with one another.
Well, one of the things you said in one of the videos that I thought was also really interesting, particularly given the fact that in spite of being a public theologian, you have written about and talked about being pretty much agnostic. So you don't identify as this, you know, as this Christian or as a particular faith person, right? But you said, and this is, again, this shouldn't be radical, but in this culture, it is the way that we think of this. You said you don't pledge allegiance to a flag, a country, a nation. You pledge allegiance to the radical politics of Jesus. But to hear someone who is essentially saying that you follow Jesus, now differently than some might say that,
yeah,
right? But that for you, that's not necessarily a theological, well, it may be theological. It's not a religious concept.
Right.
It's not a concept about believing a certain thing about Jesus. All you know is there's this radical politic, and by God, you are aligned with that. Talk a little bit about what it means and what it could mean for this culture if people who maybe don't consider themselves very religious, because we have this sort of moment right now of sort of a militant atheism that's very sort of muscular and frankly very masculine,
right,
in a lot
very
of ways.
White.
And very white.
Yep.
Very white, very male, very straight, very, upper middle income. And it shows in the way that it goes about its business,
right,
even when it makes good points about things.
And not social justice oriented.
Totally
that,
not
yeah.
at all. And in fact, very conflicted around
right?
a lot of social
right.
justice issues. In the midst of all that, what that does, I know, to a lot of people who are left or liberatory in their politic, is it just sort of turns us off to even talking about, like, we don't necessarily want to align with them, but we don't want to align with Jesus either, because then that puts us in the camp of the people that we're concerned about, the Roy Moores and whoever. So how does one embrace the radical politic of Jesus while not necessarily getting caught up in what the dominant Judeo-Christian, particularly Christian narrative says about Jesus?
Right.
What could that look like?
I mean, so because of Calvin and Luther, right, we have created a religious and theological imagination about Jesus that is disconnected from the social justice Jesus that I think Scripture talks about. When I think about the radical politics of Jesus, I am thinking about three things: compassion, love, and resistance. That this guy, you know, the stories that we have is a story of resisting empire, about loving those who are counted other, mm-hmm. is about flipping the script on what we think about religion. I mean, this guy is a brown Palestinian Jew. And if you know anything about me, you know I often talk about, like, well, I think I'm part Jew because I struggle so much with whether there's a God. And and that's true, right? Like, I could care less if there is a God
right.
that exists.
Right.
And yet I'm staking my life. I have 3 degrees in theology. I'm staking my life on this one story of this brown Palestinian Jew because I think there's something there for us to learn. I also want to say that whether a person is a theist or a non-theist or an atheist, those are all predicated on a particular imagination of theism. I think we need to get away from sort of that imagination and focus more on lived practice. How are we living? I don't care what people believe, right? Right. You can believe that unicorn is right. the god. I don't care. What I care about are people being loved. Because people are very, very unwell. Why? Because they are not loved. The level of neglect that is in this country is about a lack of care. I think that might be evil, right? A lack of care is evil. Our greatest social sin is that we don't have compassion on those who are different. One of our greatest social sins is that we continue to perpetuate empire by capitalism, militarism, and patriarchy. That is a deep, deep social sin. So I think Jesus was against that. But that is not the story that we tell in our churches. And so, you know, I'm trying to live a different politic and I'm trying to be real careful about not capitulating to sort of normative Christian discourse.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to be certain that my daily practice is one of resistance to the norm and one that continues to invite people into my life so that we can sojourn on the way.
Well, I'm glad you're doing that, and I am honored to have had some time to talk with you, and we got to do this again. And the fact that you're in Nashville means we will definitely do this
again. I love
it. Thank you so much for being here, and just keep up the great work.
Thanks so much, Tim.
Yeah, indeed.
That'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Be sure to join us next Tuesday and every week for yet another show, and look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Podomatic, iTunes, Google Play, and of course, Patreon.com, where you can sign up to become a monthly sustainer of the show and receive extra bonus content unavailable anywhere else. Special shout-outs this week to those folks who, in the past month, pledged $20 or more on Patreon. Deborah Sequeira, Matt Prescott, my old friend Shiloh Barnott Goodman, D.E. Brown, Ashley Medler, Edward Muhammad, Jason Lane, and Misty Kitchen. For this episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Jean Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin at Speak Out, my producer Jamie Lynn Moeller, and of course, Brother Ali, for giving permission to use his song Gather Round as the intro and outro music for the program. And that is where we're headed now. Till next time.